From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, could the West Texas Chihuahuan Desert be greened? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Ecological restoration is the intentional process of helping to recover an ecosystem that's been damaged, degraded, or destroyed. Deserts make up about a quarter of the Earth's landmass and growing. It's a process called desertification, where once was fertile dryland areas, like grasslands, they gradually lose their productivity and become barren. This can happen due to climate variations, but human activity, like overgrazing, is a major accelerator. Desert ecosystems like that in West Texas that have been severely damaged, depleted, eroded, and abused can be restored in theory. Sean Overton is finding out what it takes to make that happen in practice. Overton is working to turn his 320-acre Chihuahuan hard scrabble into a desert forest, and he's doing it in front of an audience on YouTube. His channel is named after his property, Dustups Ranch. Overton's dream of greening a piece of West Texas occurred to him during a trip to Big Bend.
2018, I think it was, I went out with some buddies from church and we had a nice 3 or 4 day trip out in Big Bend. But I think what was different about my experience was I just was overwhelmed with how bad the erosion is in the park. I don't know that the average person goes out there and really recognizes that it's not weird to see gullies that are 50 feet deep cutting through sand and gravel. And when I saw that, it made me really start thinking about West Texas and realizing things I hadn't noticed before, like, oh, that West Texas isn't like Fort Worth. West Texas has a monsoon. You're getting the rains in the summer. They're terribly irregular, but they at least do come in the summer. And I thought, well, that's so interesting. And because land is so cheap out here, maybe if you buy the right property, you might not have the same kind of water problem where water's flowing across the landscape. It's already horribly prone to flooding because all the grass is missing. And if you are strategic and you get the right property that has a larger catchment area and brings you a lot of flood water in a manageable quantity, then maybe that's an opportunity to do something with a property that nobody else would see value in.
So you decided to buy over 300 acres in West Texas. So how did you go about doing that?
Well, number one was convincing the missus that this was acceptable. But once I got her on board, and then I started, and I should add that I was looking for years, not seriously, just kind of thumbing through listings and looking all across Texas where I might want to buy a property. But when I actually got my wife's blessing, I knew that West Texas really was the area that I preferred, because on that budget, if you try to stay near Fort Worth, you'd be lucky to get, I mean, sometimes even just a couple acres, whereas when you go out west, you are measuring in hundreds of acres on the same budget. And the value in that for me was knowing that I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have any background in this. And if I buy a large enough landscape, I might accidentally buy the right, I might buy something that has more value than what I perceive. And that's what happened. The reason I bought the property, like the section of the property I was interested in working, isn't the actual section of the working of the property that I'm using today.
I didn't understand that last part. Explain that again.
So the reason I bought my property is there's a wash that runs through the middle of the property. It's 33 acres. And I thought, well, I'm going to buy this property that's 320 acres, but I'm really only going to use the 33 acres in the middle. And my thinking at the time was that there's so much extra land, there might be other opportunities on the other 290 acres that I'm not appreciating. And what happened was, I realized that the middle 33 acres that I intended to use with all the water gushing through was overwhelming and it would be horribly dangerous. And there's a lot of reasons it's a bad idea, but because I bought so much land, there was enough land sitting around for me to recognize, oh, there's actually better opportunities for me to focus my project on here.
Can you give me a ballpark figure on how much it would cost someone to buy a similar piece of property at a similar location?
Today or when I bought it?
Well, when you bought it and then today.
I paid $79,000 for 320 acres, which were, I forget the exact dollar figure, it's really close to that. And it worked out to $247 an acre. That price is gone. The best case scenario you would get for my area would be $400 an acre. And I see people paying up to $1,000, although I think they're grossly overpaying.
Why would people pay anywhere near that amount of money for that land? Because it's, I mean, it's like the surface of Mars.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of it is ignorance. That people don't actually go look at these properties before they buy it. They're on the internet and they don't know anything about Hudspeth County. Some of them don't know anything about West Texas. The neighbor to my south, the guy who sold him that lot, I was talking to him and he thinks he's a Nigerian immigrant that lives in Illinois. I can't even make up a reason for why he would want desert property in far West Texas. I think it's just, well, I'm on the internet and there's some land for sale and it's cheap, so I'm going to buy it. And they're just wholly ignorant of the actual value of the land or where it's located. And a lot of them buy, it's awful. It's such a huge problem in Hudson County because people buy these 10, 20 acre ranchettes that don't even have right of access. There's no easement. There's no right of way onto the property. So you're literally buying a piece of land that you can't even access.
So there's no road. There's no public road.
There's no public road. In some extreme scenarios, there's no roads for miles.
How did you deal with that? Getting to your property, describe how isolated it is, because you do describe it as one of the most isolated parts of Texas.
Correct. I think it is the most isolated spot in the state of Texas that you can drive to with a four-wheel drive vehicle. And the way I get there is I drive 7.5 hours from Fort Worth to on I-10 until I reach a small little town called Sierra Blanca that has a population of about 600 people. And then in Sierra Blanca, I go down a little road that's the end of the asphalt. And then I'm on a dirt road for anywhere from 1.5 to 2 hours. Most of that is on a county road until about the last 5.5 miles. And then it's an easement road. And it is very, very bumpy. And it's improved over the years. But when I bought it, it was in extremely rough shape. I couldn't even drive my SUV down it.
So Sierra Blanca, that's known for having a checkpoint there, right?
Yes, it is. The only people that really know where Sierra Blanca is are truck drivers or people that have been arrested for marijuana offenses and they didn't know about the checkpoint.
Yeah, they'll buy their edibles in New Mexico, try to drive back, and then they'll be popped, and it's right there. So be warned, folks.
Yeah, it's a very common issue.
Then there's no running water. There's no stream. There's a nearby well, but it's not your well. So water is also, I mean, this is a dry part of the world.
Correct. Down by the river, the average rainfall is only about 9 inches per year. Up where I am, because I'm at the base of two different mountain ranges, I get quite a bit more rainfall, around 12 to 14 inches. But obviously, it's a desert. The water situation is enormously important. When I started, I would go out there with 5-gallon jugs, and then I eventually learned how to go to the city water department and haul water out to my property when I needed it. And then, like you said, I developed a relationship with my neighbor, and because he has an unused well with really great water that's very shallow, he's now letting me draw water from that well.
Within reason.
Within reason, yeah, I can't go nuts. I'm not going to be growing cotton or alfalfa out there, but enough that I can start irrigating a small section and a reasonable amount of drinking water.
I wish more people knew not to grow cotton and alfalfa in the middle of the desert. That is that.
Well, that's actually really interesting you mentioned that, because that's the history of the area where I am. My ranch is located in Red Light Draw, which itself is really distinct in Texas because it's surrounded by the Rio Grande, and then there's one road into this valley. Otherwise, it's surrounded by three mountain ranges, and there is no other access other than this one road. But the region, and the only reason that there's really any semblance of development that out that way at all is because of World War II. That area was used for growing cotton. There's really excellent water in Red Light Draw, but it was all mostly used up for irrigation to support the war effort. That's also part of the reason that it's in really bad shape is that you had, I don't even know how many acres of cotton fields, but enough that Red Light Draw is synonymous with cotton back in the day. And then there's not a single cotton farm in sight and no full-time farmers. Nobody grows any plant-based crops. It's all, if anybody's out there farming, it's livestock.
Well, that encapsulates a lot about Texas and where we might be headed. Water is becoming a more and more scarce commodity, and places where we used to farm or even farm now, it may not be possible in the near future. And we see the desertification growing across the state. One of the reasons why, I mean, I watch your videos with great interest. I'm entertained, and I'm also very concerned about, you know, how do we form, like they have in the Sahara, they're trying to grow the green belt, if we should be doing something similar in Texas.
I think it's really important that we pay attention to the crops we're growing, because I share the same concern about water, and it's also part of what motivates my interest in the project is my own food security. We went through COVID, everybody else did, and it's really terrifying when you see disrupted supply chains and or even the snowpocalypse when our state shut down and you propane doesn't show up or whatever and everything falls apart. So I've wondered for years in the back of my mind, this whole system seems horribly fragile, and I'd rather have my own land in the middle of nowhere growing something. But of course, that leads to its own challenges of how am I going to make that happen?
Right. So let's talk about the strategies that you're deploying in order to capture the water that is made available. The problem is it all comes at once. And if there's nothing there to keep it from flowing away, that's what it will do. So it doesn't have an opportunity to penetrate the ground and grasses and other plant life. It's not able to take advantage of it. So what are you doing?
The goal for water out there isn't what most people assume. Across the whole state, you think of water as a stock tank where you build your own private little pond and you draw water when you want it or when you need it. And there are stock tanks in Red Light Draw, but many of them are millions and millions of gallons of water. But even in those rare rain events where they fill up, they're empty in 4 months, whether they use the water or not. And the reason for that is evaporation. Any surface water, especially in West Texas, the sun is brutal on it. The wind is even more brutal. So in that valley, we'll lose up to 8 surface feet per year due to evaporation. So you could have a swimming pool 8 feet deep in Red Light Draw and it'd be bone dry within a year, assuming no rainfall. I don't want surface water. Because most of the water I need isn't for my drinking. Most of the water that I want is for plants. And if I'm going to make water available for plants, it makes a whole lot more sense to put the water where plants expect to find it, which is near their roots. That has immediate benefit when you are trying to water the plants, directing water to where the plants are expecting it. But it also is providing the opportunity, but not the guarantee, to build a perched aquifer, which is where water goes under the surface and it sits and flows along the bedrock. And as long as your soil isn't too deep, then your plants above ground can actually send their roots surprisingly deep to go get that water. But that's unique to my property. It really depends on where you're located for how realistic that is.
You're building burns, you're trying to direct flow, you're creating barriers to slow the flow of water. I mean, so how long have you been doing this, and have you seen anything that shows you that this could work?
I have been working on this actively since January of last year, which is when we did our first digging, and I should have been more clear about how I'm doing it. It's all earthworks. So whether I'm building little depressions in the ground, which I call dirt bathtubs, to get water to get in there and just soak into the ground, there are some dams, but it's not to keep the water above ground, it's to get the water to soak in. There are terraces, again, the same idea, water flows on it and soaks in.
Any evidence that this is working?
Yeah. So my mentor that I met because of the YouTube channel, he does this routinely, mainly in the outback and semi-arid areas of Australia, where they get almost the exact same amount of rainfall, which is 12 to 14 inches. And you have several examples around the world. And some of those methodologies vary. You mentioned the Great Green Wall, which is just a fabulous example, where they have really made a lot of progress digging these, essentially the dirt bathtub. They have a different shape, but it's half moon shapes in the ground spaced relatively evenly. It takes up about 25% of the surface area of the ground. And it's the only purpose for these half moon shapes or the dirt bathtubs is just to get water to soak in. And there's a lot of progress, especially on the western side of Africa, closer to the Atlantic, where the countries are making a much more concerted effort to follow this Great Green Wall strategy. And there was a recent YouTube video I saw showing the results they got out of sorghum, placing those in those dirt bathtubs. And it's an astonishing image. You see this brown, dirty, dusty desert and this bright green grass growing in it with no irrigation at all. It's incredible.
So what are you seeing? You've been at this for over a year. You've got that tractors that you purchased. You're moving dirt around. You're creating these bathtubs and burns. You're burying organic material. People bring you logs and things because that's missing from this moonscape, the regolith that's out there. You're trying to create soil so things will take root. What are you seeing that gives you hope?
Right now, it's little things. So I only dug those dirt bathtubs a year ago, and a normal timeline to really start seeing evidence of change is a couple of years without seeding. But I'm already seeing volunteers growing in those dirt bathtubs.
And we mean volunteers, that's what we call plants that come out of the ground on their own.
Correct. There's already some vegetation where I'm growing, which is referred to as a seed bank. And those depressions in the ground are opportunities for the seeds to deposit in the dirt bathtubs in precisely the spot where I'm concentrating all the runoff. And I already see that happening both this spring. I even saw some volunteers in those dirt bathtubs last at the end of the rainy season last year, which would have been September, October. And then the examples I told you on YouTube or on projects around the world that they're not, even in Africa, it's a pretty huge scale. So it just depends on the mix of approaches that you look at and the way you go about things, and also the timeline. Like how big of a hurry are you in? Are you trying to just do earthworks and help it recover on its own and you be patient? Are you trying to do the Great Green Wall approach where you dig earthworks and you seed everything and you're actively managing it? But there's plenty of projects around the world that show it's possible.
Yeah, projects in Spain, Australia, Africa, lots of places. People are experimenting, trying different techniques, sharing ideas. Mexico, trying this as well. What's your favorite technique that you want to implement that you haven't been able to?
I think regenerative ranching doesn't get enough credit. You mentioned the Mexican side, and there's some really impressive results. There's a rancher out of Chihuahua named Enrique Guerrero who has this highlight project where there was a mine in Chihuahua, and it was a strip mine. And you see the images, and it looks like a scar on the earth because it was. But what he did to restore this landscape after the mine closed was ultra-high-density grazing, where they would put 100 head of cattle in a tiny little area, like well under an acre. I think it was something, I forget the exact distance, but it's a very small area. You give them all their feed, their water, all in this one spot. And what happens is the cows are basically like a nutrient factory where you're bringing them all their needs. They process that into urine and manure. They're adding organic material in the soil in addition to all the water that they're consuming. And within a year, you see green, lush grass covering what used to be a moonscape. I think if you can take a strip mine and you can restore that to a healthy grassland, it's a very promising approach. But of course, you have to be careful about the economics of that. For my site, it doesn't make sense for me to bring in food and water, but it's an approach I would have loved to try in a different context.
So you've been doing this in a very public way. When you approach this, hey, it's me, Sean, I'm going to do this. I really don't know what I'm doing. And people have been watching you online, giving you what useful advice, also showing up with to give you some sweat equity. How's that? What's that experience been like?
It's a lot better than you would expect. I think most people's impression of social media is haters and trolls. And I mean, I certainly get my fair share of that, but I don't think I would have started a YouTube channel if I was worried about that being the thing that might tear me down or discourage me from pursuing the project. For me, social media has been 90% positive because of a couple of things. One is they're kind of like my boss almost, where if I'm doing something really dumb, there is literally a million people out there that comment on my channel that you're doing something really dumb. And it makes me be a lot more intelligent and thoughtful with my actions before I actually do anything. So I think about if I do this, I mean, I'm okay with looking dumb, but it just needs to have had a reasonable chance of success before I start. And by having that accountability that I wouldn't have had otherwise, I find really helpful. And then the second thing is the ideas that come at me. Like one problem I have on the ranch is the wind. It's just ferocious out there at the wrong time of year. And I had a guy suggest using my bulldozer to build essentially an old Roman fort, where they would build these fortifications and have their camp in the center. And his idea was, I mean, there's a nice security benefit with all the migrant traffic, but it was really thinking about it as a windbreak, that if I used my bulldozer and I build these Roman-style booms, that it's already going to break the worst of the wind in my campsite, and then it might have some side benefits with water management and security and other concerns. But I never would have thought of that on my own.
Are other people doing this as well, inspired by you, or just they had already doing it? Other people in West Texas, seeing that this is a smart thing to do, could have a lot of benefit, why don't we all get on board?
I think there's a lot of interest in the idea of doing it. There's a very small handful of people actually doing it. In West Texas, it's just not been a hot spot, and I think I'm either going to be the poster boy of why this is a good idea or why it's a bad idea, which I'm fine with. I really believe it's possible. I know in my heart it's possible, otherwise I wouldn't spend time doing this, but I'm a novice and I don't have any background doing this. And of course there's the risk that I might fail. What I see happening is people contacting me and they're saying, hey, I've had this idea for a long time. Some people are a little further along where they've bought some property, but I haven't seen people actually moving to these properties or finding properties that are near them so that they can work them. I think that's certainly possible over time, but it's not happening yet.
Grass and other plants, are you collecting them elsewhere and putting them in the ground there? How does that happen?
It's a mix of strategies. The overwhelming strategy is prickly pear cactus, which I have in abundance, and most of West Texas does as well. And if you talk to the vast majority of ranchers, they hate the cactus. They'd rather just have grass. It's a lot more useful, especially as a cattle rancher. But what I love about prickly pear is two things. One is that there's a lot of things to love about prickly pear. If you grow it densely, it's a living fence, and you're not spending money on fencing, which in my part of the wood, that just doesn't make sense to spend the money on fencing. The cactus is basically a biological cistern. So if you have prickly pear is 80 to 90% water. And if you're able to get fungal networks and organic material in the ground, you can actually have the cactus share its water supply with plants growing in the shade it provides, which is the other benefit. But Also, prickly pear, you can establish it in West Texas in the sun, have it serve as a biological cistern. And what's amazing is that it also produces a lot of biomass. So you can have this plant growing on practically nothing, adding and collecting carbon that's going to eventually, you can chop it and have mulch drop right in place, and you're adding organic material right on top of your soil. It's building roots under the surface. And if you want to continue expanding that cactus, it grows its own supply. You don't even have to wait for it to go to seed. You just cut the pad and plant it a third of the way in the ground, and you're going to have a new cactus plant in 6 months.
It's also not only edible, but it's a superfood.
I don't know. I never tried a tuna, the fruit that the prickly pear produces, until I was on my own ranch, and it's like a tropical fruit.
What's the timeline when you think that you're going to be able to assess this is a success?
I think I'll see results in 5 years on the bottom terrace that I'm planting this year. And that's the one that is a lot more of an active strategy, where now that I've solved my irrigation problem on a manageable area where I can bring in a bunch of material, have labor, and really give myself the best shot of success. But I don't want that to be the entirety of the strategy, because there's no amount of labor that's going to build a desert forest on 320 acres that doesn't run an absurd budget. So it's going to be a mix of things with the dirt bathtubs, which is more or less just dig the holes, put some cactus around it, and we'll see what happens. That's part of the strategy, and I think we'll start seeing progress on that probably in hopefully this time next year, where we see some decent cover and some baby grass. And I think it'll be more camera and video friendly and look a lot better on YouTube in 4 or 5 years.
It seems like you're one person who is trying to change the world with your attempt in the West Texas desert, show that the impossible is possible with vision, hard work, you know, and some money. But, people got to tell you, you're an inspiration.
Yeah, I get that comment every day, which is awesome. My tagline is doing my part for Texas and Texans. And I am trying to reshape people's mindset about how to change things that they dislike in the world. I feel like we live in a whiny society where everybody goes to the authority and tries to impose their view on their fellow citizens by using the power of law in government, and I just don't believe in that at all. I believe if I don't like the world around me, I can't control all of these things. I can't control even what my neighbors are doing, but I can control what I'm doing, and whether it's an eco restoration project in West Texas or helping your elderly neighbor. I hope that people watch this series of me learning and struggling, and that it inspires them. It would be awesome if they wound up doing their own projects, but that they just get a better sense for you actually have agency in this world. You can do something. So focus on what you can control and not what you can't control.
Sean Overton is the owner of the 320-acre Barren Dust Ups Ranch in West Texas. He has a YouTube channel where he posts videos of his efforts to restore the area into a vibrant desert forest. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters at tpr.org, and you can download and subscribe to us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.